from West Virginia University and is a certified peer specialist in the state of Georgia. She chairs the Georgia Behavioral Health Planning and Advisory Council and has extensive experience in the consumer survivor movement, as well as expertise in wellness recovery action planning, leadership academy, peer workforce development, and mind, body, and spirit wellness. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Thank you, everyone. I want to acknowledge the funding that we receive for our center from the U.S. Department of Education, NIDER, and from SAMHSA's Center for Mental Health Services, and just go over briefly what we're going to be talking about today. We're talking about the intervention WAM, Whole Health Action Management, but as you'll learn, it has some other names too. We'll talk about really what it is, how it's being implemented in two kind of different contexts, one national and one within the state of Georgia. Some early outcomes of a randomized control trial study that we're doing together, and talk a little bit about sustainable funding through billing Medicaid. And I'm going to actually go into a little bit of detail about that because I really think that's an important issue and one of the things that's very interesting about this intervention, the way it was designed and the way it's being delivered. So WAM stands for Whole Health Action Management, and it's a peer-led intervention led by certified peer specialists, and it is intended to activate whole health self-management. We'll talk a little bit more about what we mean about that. Activation's been talked about a lot this morning, and so I think the whole question is how to not just teach people how to do something, but make them internally motivated to want to do it. It's taught in community mental health centers, federally qualified health centers, health homes, and Veterans Administration programs. And I think the best person to explain WAM and its genesis and how it's really intended to work is Sherry. So I'm going to turn the podium over to her.
Thank you, Judith. I, like everyone else who's spoken here these last couple days, am so delighted to be here. I was so tickled when I got the invitation, and imagine how delighted I was to understand that I was going to be doing a presentation with Judith. So thanks to Judith and to Judith's team, particularly Jessica and Marie Hamilton, and to Kim Skinner, who I met here today or yesterday. She's carried me for years through so many things, and she's a real human being and kind and patient for sure. I'm particularly excited to be talking about the Whole Health Action Management Program. WAM is something that has meant a lot to us in Georgia. We are delighted to be doing this work with Judith on the study, and we have been able to support people in the behavioral health system with WAM, including training certified peer specialists with the model and supporting peers with improving their self-directed health status. So more than 1,700 peers in 25 states have participated in WAM training delivered by the National Council for Behavioral Health. Our friend Larry Fricks and Ike Powell and Peggy Schwerbrick, who was here with us yesterday. Peggy probably had to go off to some other important thing because everybody wants a piece of Peggy, and she's so wonderful to support us all in our work, our various works. They developed the Whole Health Action Management program. Its first incarnation was called Peer Support, Whole Health, and Resiliency, and we were very fortunate in Georgia to be able to work on the development of it. The Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network has trained 334 Georgia certified peer specialists to become whole health and wellness coaches using WAM, and we have been able to do that through a statewide consumer networking a grant that we received through the Center for Mental Health Services, and for the very first time we were able to get the state of Georgia to actually match the funding, which says something about WAM, you know, because I have to tell you, we've been doing collaborative work with the state of Georgia for more than 20 years now, and they have never matched federal funding with anything. I believe this says a lot more about WAM than it says about anything else. So we're really excited about it. And the certified peer specialists that receive this training to actually work out there in the system with people receiving services in peer support programs, on assertive community treatment teams, and other Medicaid reimbursable services are really expressing how important and good this is for them to utilize the tools and the techniques that they acquire from the Whole Health Action Management training, and they have been able to report that people are having success with moving forward with their own self-directed recovery, which is great. WAM is also available in Spanish, and we think that that is really wonderful. Of course, as we know, our Spanish-speaking community is growing in our country, and being able to have something to connect and link with people in their native language is so important. The WAM core beliefs are people cannot be forced or coerced to change their unhealthy lifestyle habits, and peer support whole health and resiliency training needs to be voluntary. And you'll find me using WAM and peer support whole health and resiliency interchangeably because the peer support whole health and resiliency project was the first incarnation of WAM. Participants must acknowledge having health issues they wish to address. This is not for someone that says, I got it, I don't have any problems, or the doctor says, I have this, but I don't believe it, or whatever. This is directed for people who are interested, who self-identify that they have health issues and that they wish to work on them, you know. People are more likely to create a healthier lifestyle when the focus is on their interests, strengths, supports, and what they see as possible. WAM training helps people focus on what they want to create in their lives, not on what they need to change. And this is one of the big things that we found with regard to an important sort of core belief, a philosophical construct with WAM, is that it's about supporting people with focusing on what they want to build with themselves. It's focusing on what they can create. Many of us that certainly have coexisting chronic disease states along with our behavioral health concerns, have focused so long on, you know, what we need to change, and we just kind of get stuck in this endless do loop that we can't get out of. And this idea about creating new lives for ourselves, it gets us unstuck and out of that rut. And, well, it can be a miracle for some of us. People find it easier to create new habits than to change old ones. WAM training focuses on creating new habits or disciplines on a weekly basis. It's about monitoring how well they are or we are doing and accepting support from their peers. And so this is a peer-oriented model, and it's about peers supporting peers with moving forward with their own concerns. WAM has five keys to success. It's a person-centered goal built on 10 evidence-based whole health and resiliency factors that we'll talk about next. It's a weekly action plan that breaks the goal into small, achievable successes. It's a daily, weekly personnel log. It's a one-to-one peer support meeting, and it has weekly WAM peer support groups. I can't say enough about this achievable goal thing. And one of the good and the bad things about being one of the later speakers is that I can say, well, like so-and-so said yesterday, and such said this morning, but I know some of you are going, WAP, I've already heard this, you know. But I'm going to reaffirm what has been said here over the last 2 days is that, you know, when I, for example, when I set a goal of losing 100 pounds, it feels like I'm never going to get there, okay? Not that one can't lose 100 pounds, they can, but you're not going to lose 100 pounds in a day or a week or a month. You know, you maybe can lose 100 pounds in 5 years kind of thing. But, you know, who except, you know, government offices have a five-year plan, I mean, really, that you stick to, right? And no offense meant to government offices. But when you set a goal for a week and you set something that's achievable, and so, you know, I may want to build, you know, some healthier habits in my life. So say I want to increase my walking, and I'm not, and I have a very sedentary life. So I may set a goal, and this sounds so minor, but if I don't do anything except go to work and come home and sit on my couch, walking to the mailbox and back every day to get the mail is a step up to where I am now. And, you know, and I may not be up to doing that every day, so I might want to set a goal that's walking to the mailbox and back, you know, say maybe 3 times in the week. And so I set those achievable kinds of goals. I assess, you know, what my, you know, what my confidence level is. And one of the things that we look at when we set our goals and we support peers with setting goals is your confidence level high? Because the reality is that if we believe we can do something, we have a greater likelihood of doing it. And I know that a lot of what I say sort of sounds kind of, you know, hokey pokey, particularly in a room full of researchers. But I proudly carry that credential of ITE. I'm the evidence, because I know, regardless of whether there was ever another research study done or not, that I found recovery, and I no longer live in the backseat of a car. And there's a direct correlation, whether there was ever a minute's worth of study done on my life experience or not. But thank heavens, this work that we get to do together brings forward both the lived experience and the data to go along with it. So for the people that say, oh, yeah, what you have to say is very warm and fuzzy, and we can say, yes, well, there's this warm and fuzzy component, but look at the numbers, you know, woo-hoo. And so much of this is about peer support and supporting people. You know, been there, done that, you know, have the T-shirt and can show you how to get your own T-shirt, you know, kind of thing. So it's really great, and it's really important. Impact planning process. This helps a peer identify a whole health goal that improves health quality, is measurable, is positively stated, is achievable, calls forth actions, and is time limited. Weekly action plan breaks goals into small steps, achievable in 7 days. For example, eating 2 servings of fruit 3 times a week. It's very measurable. It's something that a person wants to work on, and it's easy to say, did it happen or not? You know, and the confidence scale runs from 0, which is I have no confidence, to 10, which is I'm totally confident, and it allows a person to rate whether they complete the step that week or not. It's so interesting to talk about measurable and positive and achievable, but like I said, so many of us have set goals that were not measurable, were so far out in the mist that you wouldn't be able to remember that you had that goal if you achieved it anyway. And because so many of us have lived through a system that you come in and what's explored with you is your problem list, And so if you're always looking at your problem list, it's really hard to look at, you know, what you bring to the table, your positive aspects, the gift that you have to bring to the situation. And so going through this exercise of setting positive, achievable goals actually is a bit of a hat trick in the beginning, because we're also used to sort of the other way of looking at the world. WAM's 10 evidence-based health and resiliency factors are stress management, healthy eating, physical activity, restful sleep, service to others, a support network, optimism based on positive expectations, cognitive skills to avoid negative thinking, spiritual beliefs and practices, and sense of meaning and purpose. And I know it sounds like there's an echo in the room because this has been said so many times in the last couple of days, but I think that this is just an indicator of how important this is, and really, honestly, what a no-brainer these things are, and how tragic it is that it took us so long as a field to get to this place, because we have not been looking at this for a very long time in the big scheme of things. So I'm so excited to be here, and I'm so excited to be able to work with peers around things that are so achievable, and, you know, like something as simple as a good night's sleep makes all the difference in the world. And when I get a good night's sleep, I'm, you know, there's just no stopping me. And when I'm sleep deprived, I'm not worth a plug nickel, you know. And so, and things that are important for us as individual human beings, but that are also important for us as citizens of the world. And that's one of the things about WAM that pleases me so much, is that oftentimes we recovering people have gotten insular and kind of self-focused and you know, haven't had, you know, much of a personal network or friendship network or family network or whatever. And so, you know, to recognize the importance of things like service to others and a support network and things about just our general attitude, you know, of, you know, if you can imagine, you know, before I came to do this presentation, I mean, one of the first things I did this morning was think about you all sitting out there and smiling back at me, and you all are, you know, and I appreciate that. Now, I knew I could count on this group to do that, but just coming here and knowing that there would be positive outcomes and believing that, it helps one to be able to get to the podium and to survive it with great joy. One of the important components of the whole health action management training is the relaxation response. And the relaxation response is taught as an essential resiliency tool. It can attenuate the stress-induced flight or flight response, and it counters unremitting stress that can negatively impact genetically vulnerable areas of our body to promote mind-body illness and premature death. We have so many stressors in our lives, whether we're people recovering from behavioral health diagnoses or whether we're just citizens that live out there trying to make a living in one form or another. And we as human beings have this sort of innate, you know, fight or flight response, which, you know, got us surviving back in the days when we had to run from bars and giant cats with big teeth and claws. Sometimes I have to run from my cat, but, you know, that's a story for another day. Her name's Scout, and anyone that wants to know, I'll tell you some funny Scout stories. But Scout aside, this fight or flight response isn't necessarily so healthy for us in this modern day of ours. And it creates this stress response that creates hormones and other chemicals that run through our body that actually end up, you know, working against us and hurting us. And so to the relaxation response is really, you know, just a simplified form of meditation, of focusing on your breathing, of clearing your mind in a non-judgmental way. And people that can do this on a regular basis, and there's a great encouragement from the Benson Henry Institute of Mind-Body Medicine in Massachusetts about setting aside regular times to do the relaxation response. And I actually use it, you know, I fly a lot, but I'm, you know, I'm an anxious flyer. Boy, isn't that a pity. And I don't know, I used to enjoy it, but, you know, I don't know what it is. The better my life goes, I guess the more I cling to it. But just being able to engage with the relaxation response in times of stress to keep me from, you know, keep me from focusing all the negative stuff and having all these chemicals and hormones race through my body and hurt me, it really has done miraculous things for me. And so many people talk about the positive results of the relaxation response. And Dr. Benson has done a lot of research on this, and it supports this idea. Optimism is something that we sometimes in our recovering communities find short supply of. People have complicated lives. Jessica spoke so eloquently earlier about, you know, all of the complicated hoops that people have to jump through just to access basic medical care and how to keep it all sorted out and how to, you know, how to figure out, you know, how to take care of your mental health stuff. And then, you know, so many of us have all these coexisting chronic health conditions. And so the idea of being optimistic, sometimes it's in short supply. But it's been found that optimism based on positive expectations results in really positive resiliency things for people. And I personally can attest to it in my own life. There's been a 15-year study of 2,800 patients who had undergone coronary angiography at Duke University Medical School, and it found, I mean, very profoundly, that patients with positive expectations about recovery were 27% less likely to die from heart disease over the next 15 years. Of course, it was a controlled study, and it controlled for confounds like disease severity and depression. But optimism is something that really improves resiliency factors, and resiliency is something that is so important for us, and the whole health action management training and the tools and techniques that certified peer specialists learn to support others with moving forward with their lives have had profound impact for recovering people. I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Cook to talk more about the scientific part of it. Thank you, Judith.
So the study that we're engaged in right now, it's the last study that our center is conducting, is a randomized control trial. And we have a number of collaborators, Sherry from the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network, obviously. Appalachian Consulting Group is the group that does the WAM training, and the obviously UIC College of Medicine, my group. And we're also collaborating with the Georgia Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities, which has given our study a lot of important and strong support to get underway and to get developed. People with their consent that come into the study are being randomly assigned to either receive peer support, whole health and resiliency, or WAM, delivered by certified peer specialists in either Georgia or the state of Illinois, or they get services as usual, which means nothing changes in terms of what services they're receiving. They get, in addition to that, a health manual and a $25 gift card to use toward pursuing a health goal. So that second group then is what we would think of as the control condition. And they get a little something extra to kind of take away the sting of not participating in the intervention. And we began our study about a year ago and started recruiting folks in Georgia. Now we're also recruiting people in Illinois. And I have a few initial study findings to share with you, but we're still very much in our early stages in terms of collecting data. So people set a whole health goal, which is generally something that they feel they can achieve, but each week they set what you could consider as a mini goal. All right. So if my major goal is to start eating a really good, nutritionally balanced diet because I feel that I'll feel better emotionally and physically, I don't start that in the first week. My goal for the first week is something like what Sherry said earlier, eating some fruit 3 times a week. All right. So big goal, mini goal. What we found with 24 people that have gone through the intervention is they were able to reach their big goal in 3 months of receiving WHAM. And there's a number of different goals that people have. Some people want to improve their health by smoking less, for example. Other people want to be more physically active. Other people want to increase the extent to which they give back to their community, maybe by participating in peer activities or volunteering at their church. So there's a number of different kinds of goals that people reach. But I think I don't know that for the whole study we're going to have 100% of people reaching their big goal. But I think it's interesting the focus of the intervention on something that's attainable over 3 months as well as from week to week is really important. We are studying people in this study at baseline when they come into the research. 3 months later is when the intervention ends. So people that come into WHAM meet once a week, one-on-one with a peer specialist, and attend a WHAM support group once a week as well. And they do that for 3 months, and we then measure them after that three-month period. So we would call that in research immediate post-intervention assessment. And that's as far as we've gotten so far with our initial group of research participants. And what we found is right after the intervention, they report significant increases in hopefulness about their futures. And, you know, this is in a scale that measures overall hopefulness. And they also reported significant decreases in bodily pain, all right? And so those are two of our early findings that we have come up with. Satisfaction with WHAM is pretty high. I would say it's one of the most satisfying interventions that I've studied thus far. 78% of individuals reported being very satisfied and 22% somewhat satisfied. 100% of the people we've studied so far reported that they liked getting support from peers. And the group meetings are also very popular, as well as the individual one-on-one that they have with people. Most people are reporting improvement in their whole health. 89% felt that they were healthier in a whole health sense, those dimensions that Sherry mentioned earlier. 11% reported that their whole health was about the same. No one so far has reported that it's worse. All right. 100% of people really liked the program's focus on a simple health goal. And I think this is really interesting because when we have presented WHAM to some folks, they perceive it as being too simplistic, not powerful enough. As one person said, there's not enough of the intervention there to really improve people's, mortality and morbidity outcomes. And, you know, that may be true. That's really not the focus of WHAM. It's to improve people's overall whole health. And the participants like that aspect of it, the simple goal focus. And the people that are in our study, we ask them to self-report what kind of medical conditions that they've been told they have by a doctor or other medical provider. And they report on average about 4 medical conditions. And the most common of these are hypertension, asthma, and arthritis. But I think what's really interesting is people don't necessarily come into the program and when they, you know, they're asked not to make a goal for a little while. They're asked to learn about the stress response, to learn about the role of hopefulness in both recovery of their emotional wellness, but also feeling more physically fit and physically healthier. And so nobody after that process says, you know, I want to improve my arthritis. All right, that's just they don't look at their health goal in terms of their, or I want my asthma to feel better. Okay, so I think what's interesting is people don't perceive their health goals as specifically having a one-to-one relationship with a specific illness, even though on average they have about 4 of these illnesses, which I think is really sobering to think about, you know, an intervention that's being delivered to folks that have that much medical comorbidity along with having, you know, being in mental health recovery. And the same thing with hypertension. Nobody sets a goal that says, you know, I want my blood pressure to be at a certain number. Interestingly, when they first come into WAM, some people, they're so programmed by the medical system, you know, some people feel like they have to say their goal right away, and they might even say it in terms of their blood pressure. But after a couple weeks of group meetings and one-on-one sessions, they've left that, you know, in the past. They're now thinking about their whole life, their whole health, and setting a goal that makes sense in terms of that. And I think, you know, in terms of the learning theory and theories about what causes health behavior change, what this is really designed to do is to intrinsically motivate people to make changes, not motivate them because they're scared of dying or because they want to please a family member, but because they have an internal self-driven desire to do something. So the somethings are things like, I want to get down to a size 16 dress for my sister's wedding. All right, because all my life she was the perfect sister and I was the one that had all the problems, and I want to show up at that wedding and feel good about the way I look. Or, you know, I don't want to go to the gym and work out to lose, you know, 50 pounds. I want to be able to walk up the 4 flights of stairs where my grandbaby lives and be able to go and play with him versus having to have his mom bring the baby down each time. So I think a person that makes those 2 kinds of goals is thinking a lot more deeply about what kind of life changes they want to make, what kinds of things in their life might keep them from making those changes. You know, the woman that's thinking about, you know, I want to wear a smaller dress size because I'll feel good about myself, but she's also grappling and coming to terms with that sister who always made her feel inadequate and who she felt she never really stacked up to, and how some of that might be making her feel stressed and hopeless and so forth and so on, but beyond some of that, but also know that those things are out there to maybe trip her up a little bit as she works toward her goal. There's just a lot more self-knowledge about whole health in the second kind of goal versus the blood pressure at a certain point, weight loss of a certain amount. So trying to give you examples that give you a sense of how this intervention looks simple to people, but you can see by the kinds of goals they actually then do set that they have come to a lot more self-understanding about what whole health means and have thought about all those dimensions first before they set their goal. I want to talk a little bit about how this becomes a billable service under Medicaid. Because I think that, you know, it's great that we're developing all of these interventions, and you know, I am directing a center where we're lucky enough to receive money to test things in very controlled, you know, circumstances. But at the end of the day, if we develop an intervention that is so expensive that no one can afford it, or is delivered by people that no one would be able to pay, all right, then it's just not going to take off. It's not really going to reach many people. And some scientists don't care about that. They would like to develop something and show that it works. We want to go a little bit further and look at a part of our work for our center was to look at health management interventions and health improvement interventions that work, number one, that can be delivered by a peer workforce, number two, but number three, that could be paid for by existing funding mechanisms that are out there. And those of you who were here and heard my talk yesterday, you know that what's dwindling in terms of mental health care has been state money, but what's not dwindling, and in fact under the ACA is increasing in many states, is Medicaid funding. So I think what's really clever about the way that the peers in Georgia were when they developed this was they thought about how it might be billed for. And how, if you have a Medicaid billable intervention, not only is that going to, Medicaid's going to pay for it, but it's also going to contribute to a lot of other things. Like, if the state can bill Medicaid for something peers do, is the state motivated to generate Medicaid dollars by encouraging peers to deliver the intervention? Well, yeah. So here's the way in which, and it took a lot of years to set this all up, and I want to give credit to Wendy Tigreen, because she is the person at the state level who worked with Larry Fricks and the Appalachian Consulting folks and Sherry and the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network to think a little bit about how to make this a Medicaid billable service. So the goals here, so this is the way in which the Georgia Mental Health, or the Georgia Department of, is it Mental Health and Developmental? Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities explains this intervention to Medicaid, all right? And so this is something we want to think about. If you are at the state level or you're working with the state and you want to bill Medicaid for something, you have to frame what you're doing in terms of the way Medicaid thinks about things. So what are the active ingredients in WAM? One is self-management. People are being taught how to manage their own health and their medical problems. Because remember, one of the principles is people that come into WAM have to say, I have a health goal that I want to work on, or a physical health condition I want to address. So self-management is one of the things that this intervention teaches, as is activation. And I mentioned activation earlier. It's this idea that I actually am going to take some kind of action. In this case, as Sherry pointed out, it's not stop doing something, but actually start doing something I want to do. Now, often, let's face it, the start doing something you want to do, like eating fruit, is stopping, you know, something like, you know, eating candy bars, all right? But the likelihood that it's going to happen when framed in a positive way, the development of a new habit, is what is activating about this intervention. So that's the way in which it is, you know, discussed. Dina and Sam talked earlier about activation as an important part of the WIN intervention, all right? And that's being, well, that's a Medicaid-funded in a different way and not delivered by peers. But this idea about health activation is really what we're after as the active ingredient in interventions. Here's some technical elements of how a WAM is funded by Medicaid. There has to be a ratio. We usually would talk about this as a case management ratio, but these people are not managing cases. But for every certified peer specialist delivering WAM, there can't be more than 30 people they're delivering it to at any one time. So that's the ratio for those of you who are out there thinking, you know, if I wanted to, you know, serve 100 people, how many certified peer specialists would I need? I would tell you it's a 1 to 30 ratio. So do the math and you'll know how many that would take. It requires professional supervision by an independently licensed practitioner. That's pretty typical for Medicaid billing. So someone needs to provide that supervision. And we all know there's been a lot of development recently in, if it's not a peer that's going to supervise the person, how can non-peers supervise peers doing work in a way that acknowledges and recognizes what it is that peers are supposed to be doing and what they're not supposed to be doing, so that the non-peer supervisor understands what the peer is trying to do, how to support it, how to help them do it in the right way, so that you don't have a person supervising a peer saying you should do X, and that X is against everything the peer has ever been taught about how to make a recovery plan or how to support people. It requires that the health goal be in the official treatment plan. In Georgia, it's called a recovery plan. So that means that somebody's got to put it in that plan. And different agencies in Georgia handle that differently. One agency that we worked with for our study had the certified peer specialists actually going in and adding that to the treatment plan, which meant they had to know how to change a treatment plan and phrase the goal in a, you know, a Medicaid acceptable way and so forth and so on. Sometimes the peer just reports to a case manager what the goal is, and the case manager puts it in the treatment plan, but that's important. And then finally, there's this notion of how much of the service can be done one-to-one versus over the telephone. And the regulations in Georgia actually allow, I think it's up to 40% of the interactions can be done over the phone. And if you think about the popularity of telehealth, and you think about this one-on-one meeting and what goes on, you can realize it doesn't have to be face-to-face. Obviously, it's nice at the beginning when people are building a relationship with a certified peer specialist, if it is. But further on in the intervention, maybe in the second or third month when people are really doing well, a telephone check-in can accomplish the same kind of thing. In Georgia, WAM involves a nurse. And I think the way in which the nurse is involved in Georgia is very, very interesting, because I've read the regulations that Georgia has put out about this, and they specifically say that the nurse is not in charge, that the nurse is a team member and acts, I don't know if they use the word at the direction of, but they make it pretty clear it's the certified peer specialists that are leading the team. The nurse is a member. She's almost, if I was going to use medical speak, she's sort of the medical consultant to the team. And that's there because you may have someone that you're working with in WAM that has a serious heart condition, and they may need some kind of intervention or specific information that really only a nurse has or can help them get. And so the nurse is there for guidance, to provide the medical information that might be needed, to provide referral if the person actually needs to be referred to a medical provider. That's not put on the certified peer specialist. And this answers a question that I've been asked many, many times, which is, isn't it unethical or scary that you have people with 5 or 6 comorbidities and the only individual they're seeing is a certified peer specialist who you've defined as somebody who doesn't do medical things necessarily? So the nurse can provide as little as 1 hour a month of service to the team, but she must at least meet with the team by phone or in person for 1 hour in the month. That could be a 1 hour once a month meeting. It could be half an hour, you know, a week, every month. And what the agency gets to bill for the nurse providing time is, of course, quite a bit of money, all right? And that is for a variety of reasons. Medicaid pays more for, let's say, a registered nurse, even more for an advanced practice nurse. It can be any kind of nurse. I think that's interesting, too. It doesn't even have to be a registered nurse. So quite a bit of money can be billed. I wish I could remember exactly how much. I believe it might be as much as $40 or $50. The certified peer specialists can bill in the $30 range for their time. All right? So it can be a significant amount of revenue, and of course they bill at a different rate for the group meeting than they do the individual meeting. And if you're familiar with Medicaid billing, the amount of money that can be billed for the individual meeting is more than for the group meeting. So it's specifically designed to have some elements that make it, respond to Medicaid regulations, make billing possible, provide some incentive for the agency to use the nurse, because if the nurse is used, quite a lot of money can be billed. But also for agencies, let's say you're a peer-run center, right? And you can't afford to hire a nurse. As long as you can show the state that you can have a volunteer nurse. As long as you can show them a organizational chart that says where that nurse is in the hierarchy of the organization, who that person ultimately reports to, you know, in terms of responsibility, and makes it clear that that nurse meets with the peer team on a regular basis, that's all that's required. So I find that to be absolutely fascinating, that the nurse is a critical part of the billing picture, but the nurse can be a volunteer. Of course, in many cases, the nurse isn't a volunteer. So WAM can be billed at a higher rate than certified peer specialist services just in general. But if you don't have a nurse and you want to deliver WAM, you can then bill for just plain old certified peer specialist services, get some money for that. But if you can swing the nurse and you can follow the other rules about, you know, the ratio of certified peer specialists to number of people served and so forth and so on, you can bill at this higher peer rate than would be allowable in the way in which the certified peer specialists are billed for in Georgia. So I didn't say that particularly elegantly, but I think I laid out to you what some of the issues were that Georgia grappled with in making this service elegantly billable at both a group rate and a one-on-one rate, and also that the intervention could be provided not at the more expensive level, but still billed under the regular ongoing certified peer specialist rate. There's more information about WAM at the SAMHSA Integration Center's website that you can check it out. There's more information at the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network. And if you're interested in more information about the study, there is a website that you can contact for that. I just want to take ask Sherry to come on up and take some time for some questions or some